Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. We are heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, broadcasting atop the Empire State Building. We also live stream the WBAI broadcast on WBAI.org. Our website is PCRadioShow.org. And we do have a guest that we're going to be interviewing, but before we get to him, we do have some time-sensitive news that I want to get to right away. And Joe, did you know that Chrome is throttling their background tabs? In other words, if you're running a job and you have another job running in another tab and it's not the primary one, they're going to be slowing it down, throttling it so that the primary one to get down, get done first. But the primary reason for it is to improve battery life. But they said that if you are listening to music, they won't touch that. If you're watching a video, they won't slow that down.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that the people at Chrome are listening and watching what I'm doing?
No, the thing is, when you...
You just said that if I was listening to music a video, they wouldn't do it.
And let me tell you something, Joe. When I do a lot of audio editing, and when you hear music, there is no break at all. And when there is there's someone speaking, okay, or there's another activity, you see breaks on the on the sine wave, and
just checking the sine wave.
That's
they're
all
not
they're
checking
doing,
the
right.
audio.
Yeah. So that's pretty good. Now they intend to on some very heavy jobs which are running in the background or in the other tabs, slow it down to maybe 1 or 2 seconds per minute. In other words, they'll give you one slice of 1 second processing. For 1 minute of time.
What's the benefit in their doing that?
Well, basically, when you are time slicing, all you're really doing is sharing computer time. And what they're saying is that if it's not a important job, the way that they'll probably describe how you can set it up, is that so that you don't run the battery down. They're trying to preserve battery life. They said that in preliminary testing that they've done, they are able to extend battery life 25 to 30%.
By this time slice business.
Correct, by slowing it down.
One of these days, Hank, I'd like you to report on the new technology that's taking over batteries.
Oh, yes. I'll get to that later, okay? And Microsoft, by the way, has made an announcement where they're moving everything backwards. In other words, everything used to be we move forward, everything is retrofit. You know, whatever you had before will run on something better, newer. But that's not going to be true with Microsoft on the new processors. Now, Intel has a new series of processors called KB Lake and AMD.
Called what?
It's called KB Lake. And what it is that, as you probably know, that the Intel processors are named after different bodies of water in Oregon. And, you know, so... everything that all the names they've given in the past, their bodies of water.
How do you spell KB Lake?
KABY space LAKE. So that's a body of water, and that's a new series of chips. And AMD has matched them with Ryzen, RYZEN. And on those new chips, they are being put in newer machines. Now, what Microsoft's saying is that if you want to put Windows 7 on those machines with those new processors, you will not get any updates. In other words, as soon as you put it on and updates are needed after you install, you're not going to get it. They are inhibiting it.
But is there anything in the code that wouldn't run on the older machine? The reason I ask you that is there's an obvious way to get around that.
Well, anything that you have installed will run on the newer machine. The problem is if you can't get the new code in, how would you do it? Now, there are, to me, you know... Well, I would do it a little differently, but you know what? We'll talk about that when we have time. How's that?
I've just been censored.
No, you have not. But I just want to let everyone know that if you plan on moving Windows 7 to the new processor, fine. It's going to work. Windows 7 will work with a new processor, but if you want to upgrade it to 10 on the new processor with that 7, it won't upgrade properly.
It won't upgrade, will it run?
It will run, but you're not going to get any updates in order to continue to run.
Well, later I'll tell you how you can.
Okay.
Then.
And lastly, this is just to let everyone know, and we mentioned this a couple weeks ago, on April 11th, Microsoft is killing all support, all patches, all updates, anything to do with Windows Vista.
Well, the only comment I can make there is, boy, it's a long time coming. If I had been Microsoft, I would have done that years ago.
Well, I don't know. Now, let me get, we have a special guest on, and it's Evan Koblitz. And I've known him for the past couple of years, and he runs something called, at least I call it, the Vintage Computer Festival, and now it's under a new name, Vintage Computer Federation. Evan, are you on?
Yes, I am. Hello, Hank.
How are you? How are you doing? Listen, a lot of people doesn't know, they don't know what the Vintage Computer Federation is. What is the mission of this Vintage Computer Federation?
The Federation is a national user group. We're a 501c3 nonprofit, and basically we're just a user group for people whose hobby is collecting, restoring, and presenting historic computers. Very similar to how people would collect, preserve, and exhibit historic vehicles, for example.
Oh, in other words, it's for pack rats, and it's one day I'm going to fix this machine, but you have these machines that are already up and running, though, right?
Well, it's interesting because there are some of us who are actively collectors, and there are other people who are passively accumulators, to use a computer term. So there are some people who are collectors and just don't know they're collectors yet.
Now,
but we are about hands-on restoration, not just garage cleans or not just having for the sake of it.
Okay. Now, you have a special three-day schedule event. When is it?
So we have annual events called the Vintage Computer Festival Series. There's one in Silicon Valley, August 5th and 6th. And the most immediate one is Vintage Computer Festival East 12, March 31st to April 2nd at our museum in Wall, New Jersey.
Is there a special address? Because, many people, Wall Museum is like, it's just a building, but how do you get, I get the wall, where do I go? Any address?
Forget that. Evan, the big question is, I'm coming from Manhattan. Where am I going? I never heard of Wall, New Jersey.
Fair enough. Wall is right by the much more famous town of Asbury Park.
Oh,
Springsteen
I know
Country,
that.
Point Pleasant, Belmar, yeah.
Yeah, I know where that is.
So our snail mail is 2201 Marconi Road. But from Manhattan, you could take New Jersey Transit trains, which will to the Belmar, B-E-L-M-A-R, not to be confused with Belmar, M-A-W-R, different town.
I'm already
and that will
confused.
Put you a mile or two from our facility where you could take an Uber or a cab. Walk if it's a nice day.
Well, let me jump ahead and ask you, what's the website that they can get more information on this?
That's easy. Our organization's website is Victor Charlie Foxtrot Echo Delta, so VCFED.org.
Repeat that again with just the letters.
Sure. V as in Victor, C as in Charlie, F as in Foxtrot, E as in Echo, D as in Delta.org.
Oh, okay.
Because we're a Vintage Computer Federation, so VCFED.org.
Now, I've been to your website, and with this festival, you also have exhibitors. Who are some of the exhibitors that we might be interested in?
Right. Well, let me just briefly say first. So the way the festival schedule works is Friday's agenda is technical classes along with a lunchtime keynote, and then Saturday and Sunday's agenda has a keynote each morning, and then following the keynote, the exhibit halls, the museum, and the consignment sale open. The show is not a flea or a swap, however. We have about 40 exhibitors this year. Everything from common 8-bit micros, Commodore, Apple, Atari, Tandy, et cetera, all the way back to punch card and paper tape powered mini computers, and of course all the S100 and Hobby Kit era, Apple One, things like that in the middle. Every year is a few unique things. This year there will be an actual Apple One on display working. We're having three special exhibits this year in honor of the 40th anniversary of the appliance computers. So those are the Commodore PET, the Apple II, and the TRS-80 Model 1. Someone's doing an exhibit of Cold War computing relative to the SAGE system, the missile defense system. There's an exhibit about FORTH programming. There's an exhibit about Kermit networking, believe it or not. Let's see, there's an exhibit here, PDP-8 raster graphics, chiptunes. So there's something for everybody. no matter what, you know, whether no matter how long your beard may be, what color it is, there's something for everyone in different parts of computing. Well, and it's very family friendly. It's not a conference, professional conference. Everyone from families and kids to those of us with long gray beards.
Well, let me ask you this. I have a lot of, let's say, I've been in working with computers about 50 years now, and I have a lot of equipment that, you know, my wife is saying, you know, when are you going to get rid of all that stuff? If I think it's collectible, or, you know, there are other people like me with it, what do I do? Who do I contact? Can I just give it to you, or you have to look at it first, or you have to know what it is?
Well, yeah, we are selective about it. First of all, we only accept donations. We don't purchase artifacts. To be an exhibitor at the festival, you have to register. Our registration is long since closed. We're full. We do have a consignment sale where you could just show up. But if you want to donate something to our museum, you would contact me, Evan, at vcfed.org, or talk to me at the show, and we would explain the process and show you our paperwork and let you know if we're interested or not. Even if we're not interested, I mean, how many Apple IIs do we need? Even if we're not interested, we very actively have a system where we place good artifacts with good homes, sort of a vintage computer adoption agency, if you will.
Well, you know, I have something that I was wondering if it would qualify for your museum. I have one of the original masks for the Intel 486. It's 2 feet by 3 feet in size that I got from Intel. I was on their advisory board, and it's one of the original masks, you know, the semiconductor mask. Would that be considered a computer collectible?
Sure. I mean, we don't just do the actual computers. We do software, peripherals, ephemera, documentation, books, magazines, you know, media, you name it. Something like you said is something we could do anything from hang on the wall to, you know, we always change our exhibits up on a regular basis. So perhaps one of these days we'd have an exhibit of processing history, you know, that sort of thing, or you know, the technology behind the technology. And so we might go in a warehouse and pull it out when it's time for that exhibit.
So in other words, if I have a slide rule on abacus, that would qualify?
Sure, that's computing. In fact, it's interesting you say that. A couple of years ago, 2015, I published a book called Abacus to Smartphone about the history of mobile computing, and that's certainly where it starts. If you think about it that way, there was mobile computing before there was non-mobile computing.
Well, I have an abacus that is a couple of generations old, and I don't know, my grandchildren, they look at it, and they think it's a bunch of beads strung together. Oh, let me ask you.
Yeah, well, an abacus is interesting because you're the one doing the computing, not the tool.
I know. Let me ask you, what's the admission charge to attend the festival?
It's $20 for one day, $35 for 2 days, or $50 for all three, and kids are always free.
So, Evan, is people who are listening to the program right now might be going over to that URL that you gave to Hank. Is there an early bird discount?
No. However, we have online ticketing now until this Sunday night, and then we close it. The main advantage to buying tickets online is you just save time at the gate so you can get inside sooner.
Because many of our listeners are podcast listeners. In other words, because of the hour and depending on, you know, what day we're on and so on, I suspect that many of our listeners download this a day or two later. So this kind of information hopefully will be useful to them. You know what? I'm going to let you go because you probably got – I know you've been very busy. I've been trying to get a hold of you during the day, and you weren't available. But do you have any final thoughts of what you think would be something that young people would like to look at? Because when you talk the word vintage, it means something old, but many of the young people wouldn't even understand what a dial
phone
is.
Sure, I mean, you know, I'm 42. I grew up on an Ipsa computer. There are people – you know, frankly, your age, Hank, you know, more interested in...
Be careful how you say it now.
Evan, there's a lot of people who've been listening to Hank for a long time, but as far as I know, there's no one his age.
No, Hank and I are good friends. We go way back. Yeah. But I was going to say was there are people half my age whose idea of a vintage computer is Windows 95 they grew up on. Now, we're not going to allow that in the show, but we are every year edging a little closer toward the PC era. One thing I do want to mention is some of our exhibits and some of our Friday talks have a modern slant. For example, one of our talks on Friday is called 3D Printing with 8-Bit Computers. And some of our exhibits Saturday and Sunday are about how to do modern hacks for vintage computers, everything from networking to, you know, the solid-state memory. So there's a lot of interesting ways you could incorporate modern technology with historic computing.
Evan, why don't we finish up by you telling us who's the speaker, keynote speaker for Saturday, and who's the keynote speaker for Sunday?
Well, let's start telling you who the keynote speaker for Friday is first. The keynote speaker for Friday is Tom Pereira, PhD. He's one of the Rawls experts in the Enigma machine. He'll be talking about Enigma machines, and then after his keynote, he's actually giving a class in which he's going to disassemble and reassemble an Enigma machine for the audience. The Saturday keynote speaker is Dr. Bjarne Stroustrup, better known as the inventor of C++. And a couple years ago, we had, you know, Brian Kernighan of K&R fame, C and Unix, so a nice follow-up to that. And then Sunday's keynote is a panel discussion about the 40th anniversary of appliance computing.
Evan, thank you very much for all that information. And once again, for those who are interested in learning more about it, just give us that website again.
Sure. Victor, Charlie, Foxtrot, Echo, Delta, so vcfed.org. And Hank, I'll be happy to donate a pair of tickets to any of your readers if you want to give some away.
Okay. Listen, I hope you have get some good weather. And thanks a lot.
Thank you.
I'll see you another day. Take
care. All right. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay. Take care. You know, Joe, we're talking about what's the latest and so on. And one of the things that struck me was we have regulators in this country. And
we do?
Yeah.
I heard that we're getting rid of them all.
Well, right now there is an acting regulator in the position, and she is talking about the Internet of Things regulation. And, of course, we've been talking about the need for regulation. It's like a Wild West out there, where they're talking about billions of devices being installed, and there's really no technical standard, there's no communication standard, and yet they're talking about billions going to be installed. Can you imagine what it's going to be like when they have cars, everyone design their own driverless car?
I'm not really concerned, Hank, with what you're just talking about, but I'm very concerned with the security aspect of it. I don't want to put a thermostat into my house that can be controlled by my next door neighbor, and I don't want a thermostat running on my home computer network if it's going to open up my very secure files to everybody downstream of me. There has to be some regulations. If, for example, Hank, I have network installed storage, NAS. You can't get into it. I've highly protected it myself. You can't get anywhere near it unless you're a really professional hacker. Well, but there's nothing to stop you from opening my garage door, and then through my garage door, you're able to see what my personal banking information
is. Well, let me ask you, were you surprised to learn from the Julian Assange release where a Samsung smart TV, even when you have it turned off, but it's never really off, as you know, because it's always on, can spy on you?
No, I was not surprised by that at all.
Now, with all that information going on, I tell you what I was surprised by is that the current acting head on this particular project, she said that the government has no intention of coming up with regulations until something drastic happens. Are you going to wait for disaster to happen before you come up with regulations?
Have you noticed how, for example, Andrea Katz signs her email?
I don't know.
He's not somebody who I have a lot of faith in.
Well, she's saying that, there's no one really in that position until they start filling the jobs, but she's saying that they don't want to speculate about the harm that may happen in the next 5 years, because you can come up with regulations that is not relevant to what may happen, and that's her point.
That's very good. And if she were in charge of the so-called driverless car, she would wait for a major smash-up on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, which kills 187 people and 3 children, and then she would put some regulations in. She's an idiot.
You know, I was at a computer festival this past weekend, and a keynote speaker asked a simple question. We had a couple hundred people in the audience. He said, how many people would be confident to sit in a driverless car? You know how many hands went up?
One.
Two. That was it.
Who was the other one? No, the thing is, if they had narrowed it down a little bit, even those two hands wouldn't have gone up. And if you had said, sit in a driverless car that is controlled by Windows. And those two hands would have gone down immediately.
Well, there was a survey that was done because they're talking about the year 2020, there'll be 24 billion devices that are interconnected with each other in some loosely, some fashion. And 24 billion is probably a low number. It's a tip of the iceberg. That's huge. And so a survey was done where, and I was surprised by this, from a public perception point of view, 44% of Americans were very concerned about the possibility of their information being stolen from their home. In other words, almost half the people don't trust it.
No, that's not the point, Hank. Who are the idiots who do trust it?
The other half, I guess.
I mean, it's
no, no. Actually, the other half could be. I don't know.
The question is such an obvious one. Hank, you've been around a long time. Remember when Ethernet was first introduced?
Well, there was Ethernet, there was Token Ring, and many different forms of...
Ethernet beat out Token Ring eventually.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure before that, there was something before Ethernet. I don't know what it was.
It was two tin cans.
With a string.
Right.
The point being that we first established some standards, and then the whole industry was able to grow. And without those standards... we're in trouble, and we're in trouble now because somebody in the government doesn't have enough foresight to see what's happening.
Well, what it is that I was surprised by the numbers that many of the technical companies, 85% of them, are developing standards relative to their products. And of that, I dug down a little further, I drilled down. And it's really four or five companies that are really coming up with overall standards. Of course, one of them is Intel. I think that's no surprise.
Cisco's also.
Right.
Let me give you a very personal experience. I had an automatic locking and raising door situation for my garage, a door raiser and automatic locking. And they said to me, do you want to have it internet connected? And my first reaction was, no, I don't. And then they said, well, the advantage of it is with your cell phone, you'll be able to open the garage as you start getting close to it. I said, well, I can do that with the old-fashioned one that you give me a garage opener. He said, yes, but wouldn't you rather have everything on your cell phone?
Well, also, if it's on your cell phone, you can open and close the door 1,000 miles away.
Exactly. You can do that, too. And he said, the other advantage is you can put in as complicated a password as you want. You want a 128-bit password or a 256-bit password, you can do that too. So where was that door made? I asked. He said, Germany. How far ahead of us in thinking are those people?
Well, I think that a big concern that that people were surveyed was that you have this massive amount of data and you could build a profile from it and who has access to it and what abuse can be made with that massive amount of data, because you can actually build a whole profile of a person with all that data, especially now. I know that a little later on we're going to have a couple of segments from our associates. Like Dr. Alfred Poor is going to be talking about wearable technology. Can you imagine a lot of that data from wearable tech floating around, and then it's all part of this Internet of Things connected together so that hospitals can have the information immediately, the doctors can have that information?
I believe it was just a few months ago.
But what hackers can also get into it, too.
I was going to say, just a few months ago, some hackers figured out how to get into the, I won't call it a network, but the area information for pacemakers, and they could, in theory, have stopped a pacemaker, which would kill somebody. I ask you, would you like a pacemaker put in that any hacker could get into? Would you like to have a drug delivery system, for example, for diabetics, that any hacker could get into? Until we get standards, and everybody has to be certified on their security for medical devices and for safety devices, I'm not getting near that stuff.
Well, what concerns me is that According to the latest numbers we have, is that 89% of the U.S. population are using the internet, which is a very high number, 89%, and that about half of them are using it on a smartphone, meaning it's Wi-Fi, which it scares the hell out of me because where's the security?
I use a smartphone. I attach it to Wi-Fi.
You do banking on it?
Well, I left out one other step. I also only do Wi-Fi that's under my VPN, my virtual private network.
I repeat, you do banking on it?
No, I still don't do banking on it, but I do yeah. business on it. I do purchasing and sales.
Yeah.
But the point being that you can have a very accurate VPN, which is as good security as somebody like me is going to get. Yes, if you speak to Michael Horowitz, he'll give you even better ones. Or you can go to Louis Freer, the former head of the FBI,
right.
whose answer to security on the security on the internet was very simple. I don't use it, he said. I use a VPN that's provided at absolutely no charge by Opera.
Right. Now let me ask a simple question. And what if Opera got hacked? Have you thought about what would then happen?
Yes, I do. I did. Opera can get hacked all at once, and it's still going to be very difficult for them to hack into the channel that I'm using because it's encrypted, end-to-end encryption. They don't have the ability, they do not have the ability to read the encryption.
But if what it was hacked to enable them to do it?
What? I'm sorry?
What if it had been hacked to enable them to catch the information?
You're asking for a hack that's beyond my comprehension.
Oh, okay. Well, that's where we're moving into a wireless society, and I was very surprised by it. And by the way, with millennials, 55% of all their activity is on a smartphone, with the internet. Even when they're home. And you know what? They probably have good eyesight because I would have a tough time reading the numbers.
Well, I happen to know, and I don't want to embarrass you, Hank, but I happen to know that about 2 years ago, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less, you used your phone for 100% of one activity and only for that one activity.
What activity?
Phone calls.
Oh, well, first of all, by the way, I just want to tell you one of the big problems I've been having is there is really a standard at the same time no standard for batteries because you know what happened in the last 2 weeks, daylight savings time, right? And you're supposed to with daylight savings or you move it 1 hour for 1 hour back, change the batteries. Do you do that?
As a matter of fact, I did, and I came up with a very shocking result. I took down one of my, I think they're called smoke alarms.
Yeah.
It's more than a smoke alarm. It does carbon monoxide and some other things. And on the back of it, in magic marker, I had written when I had changed it so that I could, continually not have to. I changed it last 2 years ago.
You see?
Well, but it was still running.
Well, we're going to be doing a couple of segments, and Marty Winston's going to be talking about batteries because I asked him, I would like to be able to have computing devices that don't need batteries. And then Alfred, he's into wireless. I want to hear more about him. And, of course, each week we do want to hear more from Joe Rejeski, what computer tip that is simple for the busy person, don't we?
I'm hoping to.
Okay, well, we're going to get to that right now.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. People have a lot of complaints about social media. Some people feel that people spend far too much time interacting with their phones and not interacting with live people. And there's some truth to the issue. Like all technology, social media can be used for good or bad. And there's some interesting developments that may show some positive use for social media channels. Facebook has revealed that they're now using artificial intelligence to help combat suicide among its users. According to their post, suicide is the second leading cause of death among young people 15 to 29 years old. And when you stop to consider that Facebook has 1.2 billion users active on the site every day, that's about 1/6 of the world's population. You can figure that a lot of those people may be at risk of suicide or self-injury. The company for some time has had a system in place where users can alert the Facebook staff that there's somebody who might be at risk. Facebook then follows up with offers of support and sees if there's any help that they can offer the person. But in addition to this reporting service, they've now started a beta test of a system using artificial intelligence to look at the posts of people and see if they can identify patterns that might indicate that the individual is at a higher risk for suicide or self-injury. If the posts are flagged this way, then they're brought to the attention of Facebook staff in their community operations team, and those people will then reach out to the individuals and see if they can offer some help. Now, at this point, according to Facebook, this is an experimental program, and it's only being tested in the United States at this point. If this works, we could see ways that smartphones and other technology could be proactively used to help people with needs. Another concern that people have with technology these days is the amount of time that children spend in front of screens. We're seeing childhood obesity go up. It seems that children are getting less exercise. There's a lot of factors involved. Families have greater perceived risk of letting children go outside and play on their own independently. But certainly the siren song of technology and screens, whether they be television or smartphones or tablets, they are very enticing and can easily consume a lot of time, not just for children, but for adults as well. Researchers in the United Kingdom were curious about this, and they wanted to see if there was a correlation between the amount of time that children watch screens during the day and whether or not they're at risk for diabetes. They actually had a survey sample of nearly 4,500 9- and 10-year-old children, and they relied on the children to self-report how much time they watch screens. They also gathered physical information about the children, their weight, their height, and other biometric measures. They also followed up with about 2,000 of the children in the study to monitor how much exercise time they got. And the results were pretty startling. While the researchers don't claim that this is the ultimate answer to the question and that more research is needed, they did find a strong correlation between how much time children watch screens during the day and their risk for diabetes. They found that children who looked at screens for less than an hour a day had significantly lower chance of diabetes than those who watched 3 hours or more. That result makes sense. It's good to have some hard numbers to back up what we might logically conclude on our own. I continue to be amazed at what modern medicine can do. Diseases that were a death sentence even 20 years ago are now manageable. Some can be cured, and if not cured, at least some can be slowed and delayed. One of the primary areas where this is true is cancer, though some of the treatment required can be a bit extreme. Patients who are undergoing chemotherapy treatment have to spend long sessions in hospitals and clinics receiving the medication, which can make them uncomfortable. They just have to sit there in the clinic for hours and hours on end. It can be a difficult time. It can be scary. They can be bored. There's just a whole lot of emotions, and most of them not positive, that can run through a patient's mind at times like that. Samsung and a cancer treatment center in Australia came up with a novel way to help these patients. It was the brainchild of a gentleman who creates virtual reality content in Sydney. He was the spark plug that got the partnership going. And basically what they did was they tested using virtual reality content on the chemotherapy patients while they were receiving treatment. The idea was that this would give them a way to distract themselves from their current setting, to transport them to another place, a more pleasant place that they might enjoy, sort of a quick vacation where they could interact and move around in another environment, another setting. And the program was very successful. The patients loved it. The clinical staff loved it. It had a very positive impact, helped them relax and get through their treatment sessions more comfortably and happier. This is kind of an interesting bellwether kind of program. Rather than using a wearable like virtual reality to directly treat a disease, it shows how it can be used as a way to augment existing treatment and make it more effective and make it more comfortable for the patient. Programs like this could help patients maintain a more positive attitude, which can be a factor in helping them heal. In the future, we may see more use of virtual reality in clinical settings to help patients deal with some of the anxiety and fear that they have with their medical treatment. I want to mention that I'm honored to be the keynote speaker at the Digital Health Show next week in Melbourne, Australia. If you're attending the conference, please stop by and say hello. And also, if you're in the New York City area, I want to let you know that I'll be presenting my Stay Home, Stay Safe program, which is about how technology can help seniors continue to live independently in their own homes. The program will be at New York University on April 13th at 7 p.m., and it's hosted by the New York Amateur Computer Club, which is also known as NIAC, its initials. The program is free, and there's no reservation required. Details are available at the NIAC website, which is nyacc.org, NIAC.org. So if you're in the New York City area, I hope to see you then. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Public service announcements. Brookdale Computer User Group will have a presentation on Picking the Best Backup Approach Thursday, March the 23rd, 7 p.m. It will be held at the Middletown Library in Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PC's User Group will be having a presentation on Perfecting Your Computer Backup, The Art of Backup, Tuesday, March the 28th, 7 p.m. Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Vintage Computer Festival East, Talks and Exhibits, Friday, March the 31st through Sunday, April the 2nd. And the festival hours are 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Friday, the keynote is at 2:10 p.m. Topic is Inside the Enigma. Saturday, keynote is at 9 a.m. and it's the origins and further evolution of C++. And on Sunday, the keynote topic is The Year of the Appliance Computer, 9 a.m. It will be held at Info Age Science Center, 2201 Marconi Road, Warr, New Jersey. Website is www.vcfed.org. That's the Vintage Computer Festival East. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing will have a presentation on backing up your computer, Tuesday, April 4th, 2 p.m., 999 Lower Ferry Road, Ewing, New Jersey. Hey, I think I'm getting through to the clubs at least, and I hope everyone is backing up their data. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be having their main meeting April 7th at 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will be having its general meeting on April the 13th. And the topic of presentation is Stay Home, Stay Safe, How Technology Helps Seniors Remain in Their Own Homes. And the presentation will be given by our very own Dr. Alfred Poor. That's Thursday, April the 13th at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, and photo ID is required.
What is that strange key on the keyboard with the Windows logo? Is it the new 27th letter of the alphabet or something? Hey, it's time for simple computer tips for busy people. Busy people like you. I'm Joe Rejeski, author of the soon-to-be-released Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Here's a simple, cool computer tip you need to know. In the lower left-hand corner of the keyboard, there's a key with a Windows logo on it. What does it do? Well, you probably have never pressed that button. Go ahead, give it a shot. You'll notice that on its own, it opens the Start menu. Not very impressive, right? I got you. But there are a few cool things you can do with the Windows key. One of my favorite tips is locking my computer from prying eyes. Now, let's say you're stepping away from your desk and you don't want anyone seeing the top secret project you're working on. They just wouldn't understand your genius. I understand what it's like to be an unrecognized genius. Actually, I don't. I have absolutely no idea. But anyway, just lock the computer by pressing the Windows key and the letter L. Easy to remember, right? Lock starts with the letter L. Windows key, L. However, before you press the Windows key and the letter L, make sure you know your password. You'll need to press Control-Delete to unlock your computer and then enter your computer password. I don't want to see you getting locked out of your house without the keys. Another great shortcut is Windows key and the letter E. Try it. Whenever you need to find a file, copy a file, or delete a file, instead of using the mouse, just press the Windows key and E. The E stands for Explore, as in Windows Explorer, which will instantaneously materialize before your eyes. Another favorite is the Windows key and D. D is for desktop. Yes. If you want to minimize all open windows, just push everything down to the taskbar. Just press the Windows key and the letter D to show your computer's desktop. Press it again and all windows will return to their previous position. Okay, ready for one more? You got it. Okay, this one is for you, you multiple monitor people. You'll need more than one monitor for this trick. And it's a little tricky to memorize, but you'll probably find it's worth it. If you hold down the Windows key and the Shift key, absolutely nothing will happen. But if you then press the left or right arrow key, the active window will jump to another monitor. So if you're working on something, you want to quickly move it to another monitor, just press the Windows key, Shift, and then the left or right arrow keys. Yes, you can move windows using your mouse, I got it, but try using the keyboard right now and you'll be amazed. It's really cool and very quick. And there you have it, four cool tips with the Windows logo key. Windows key and L to lock your computer, Windows key and E for File Explorer, Windows key and D to show your computer desktop, and Windows key Shift and either right or left arrow to move a window to another monitor. Try these tips now and you'll never forget them. And that's this week's Simple Computer Tips for Busy People. Do you have a computer tip for me? Let me know. Just visit www.simplecomputertipsforbusypeople.com. I'm Joe Rujewski. Over and out.
Thank you, Joe. Spring forward and fall back. Reset the clock and change batteries in essential devices like smoke alarms. But it's not always practical with other devices. The Fios backup battery is expensive. It's about $40 to $50, and it's only good for 2 years. Many devices use customized batteries. Batteries, batteries. Can we live without batteries? Hey, Marty Winston, do you have any thoughts on this?
Okay, granted, I'm building an ultra-automated house. 40yearhouse.com has info if you want to go look. But what does computer control have to do with plywood? That's what we're on today. And it has to do, ultimately, with batteries, which I want to absolutely forbid in this house because people are terrible at babysitting batteries. Instead of batteries, we're using a DC bus, not a single one either. What we're doing is taking a computer UPS that's plugged into a power outlet that is on a generator. So as Hank says, backup, 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 and backup the backup. That is powering a computer PSU, power supply unit, which very handily is good at generating high current levels of 3.3 volts, 5 volts, and 12 volts, the same voltages that we need for almost all the automation stuff. A few things need 24, they get their own supply, already got those, that part was easy. But wait a minute, what if something needs, maybe 1.5 volts or 1.7 volts because it's only one battery? Old trick for that. Put a diode in series. The diode drops forward current by anywhere, depending on the diode, between half and 0.7 volts. You can figure it out one way or another. You have what you need. Also, I have a bench power supply, and I can test every piece of gear we need to connect for the maximum and minimum voltage that keeps it operational. So the fudge factor is something we don't have to guess at. We can test for it, find out, confirm it, and then create a little right-in-place adapter that means no batteries, nothing to die, nothing to try to figure out how to troubleshoot when you've forgotten where the heck you put everything, and that is so common in home automation, don't even want to go there. So, okay, here we've got these clusters. We actually have three pieces, a UPS, a PSU, and in the same place, plugged into the UPS, a 100 megabit Ethernet switch. And that is to connect the Raspberry Pis, because with the amount of data we're transacting and the number of nodes we're dealing with, wireless can't hack it. We need faster speeds. We can't have constant, you know, checks for whether or not errors happened en route and things need to be resent. We don't have that kind of time. We're dealing with very high volumes that have to go through a network of controllers. So wired Ethernet has lots of elbow room where wireless would be swamped. So these three things are together, and we decided, you know, you got a lot of current. You've got the three voltages. How many places do you need those? Well, I don't know. You don't know. We haven't built the stuff that's plugging into them yet, so it's hard to know for sure how much current we're going to need. So arbitrarily, not entirely arbitrarily, I looked at where things would be, made the decision to cluster six DC buses, six things that plug into AC power to derive three DC voltages, 3.35 and 12 volts DC. Now, three voltages, you don't have to be around electronics for long to know three voltages means four wires, one at ground and then the other three, 3.35 and 12, against that one ground. It's the same ground for every voltage. Same ground is very important. Get into that in a second. Now imagine your attic. Imagine we had six times those three pieces with wiring. That, not counting the wires, that's 18 pieces of gear in your attic. How well organized is your attic? How many places do you have to put this stuff? And that's where the plywood comes in. I decided we need to house the power in cubes. Where'd I get that idea? Power cubes? Different kind of thing. So I went to Home Depot. I bought an 8x4, 96 by 48 inch piece of 5/8 inch plywood and had the guys there cut it so that I could make boxes that were 12 by 12 by 16. Approximately. Cuts are not exact. I don't care. Good enough to fit this stuff. I got some Rust-Oleum Primer Plus paint in one in spring green because we're trying to be green with the house, right? Painted the boxes, let the paint dry, glued and screwed them together, added corner posts inside. Why? Isn't that overkill? Isn't that kind of thing overkill? Well, it might be, but it's in an attic. Some brilliant person at some point is going to decide he can step on the box. And when that happens, I don't want that box to break. I don't want the gear inside to be part of the tumble. So, well, I have inspected for it. I do expect that these boxes can handle that kind of, shall we say, accident. The front and back are open because we need to pass wires and because we need to allow airflow to make sure cooling can happen. In so doing, however, I'm putting a polyethylene plastic window screen on the front and back so that there is some degree of isolation against things that might want to crawl or fly in there. Note also that these boxes reduce the amount of noise that can be made even from the fans and things that a PSU will tend to have. Also note that a PSU that is not driven very hard, and this is an old rule of thumb kind of trick, the harder you drive a PSU, the more you bring it toward its capacity, the more likely it is to create internal heat, and the more internal heat it endures, the more likely it is to fail earlier. Heat is an enemy to longevity across almost all of electronics. So dividing whatever the load is by six seemed to make sense. The clusters of computing and sensing power in most of the house ceiling is in 30 locations. And those 30 locations are a cakewalk for this much current being available. So, okay, we've got a lot of current. We've got a lot of voltage. What is it we need to do to dodge disaster? Well, to dodge disaster in this case, the one most important thing we need to do is to make sure that ground is ground is ground is ground. Electrically tying together all of the DC grounds, all of the power grounds, all of the lightning protection grounds, everything that could be ground gets tied together with either that green ground wire that is common in electrical or with tinned braided cable that I use when I need to lash things, solder it down, do that kind of thing. Got plenty of both. Ground is ground is ground means that, among other things, well, you've got a Raspberry Pi, right? And it's getting USB power, the 0-volt part of which should be grounded, because if it isn't, when it plugs into the ground it sees on the signal cable of an Ethernet connection, those grounds being different cause damage to the board. You don't want ground to be anything but ground. It's a discipline thing. Ground is ground is ground, which also means that 3.3 volts that a Raspberry Pi derives for itself from its 5-volt supply to feed its I.O. bus is exactly the same 3.3 volt level that I am providing on the DC bus wires in the house. Ground is ground. 3.3 is 3.3. 5 is 5. 12 is 12. You don't have 12s floating or 5s or 3.3s floating at different values. They're all tied to the same ground reference. Ground is ground is ground. It's a huge help in this kind of circumstance. And anybody who's ever been a ham radio operator knows what happens if your grounds don't match. Not a good thing. So how do we handle the bus? Well, I found a bargain at Amazon. 14-4 cable, which is 4-conductor, 14-gauge cable. They call it speaker wire. I don't care what they call it. 250 feet for $38, and I just did an impulse buy. I brought that, and I cut it into 6 segments. Each of the segments about 40 feet long. I looped the ends down to a middle and did a wire tie in the middle to isolate it. The 4 wires in there will attach to the 0, 3, 3, 5, and 12-volt connections on the PSU. And the way they attach, I put every connection from the PSU onto this cabling. And it's in the middle of the cabling, because it's in the middle of the room, because it goes in both directions, so the current load is distributed along the wire. Little things to worry about, because wire does have resistance. The more current you're drawing, the more that's a factor in reducing the voltage you get. Now, speaking of that, the end point of each end of each wire, in other words, 12 places, both ends of 6 wires, has a bank of 3,000 microfarad capacitors. And those are simply kind of boosts. They're kind of a, a reserve tank. If some draw gets so hefty that it's going to draw down the current from the PSU, that same voltage is at the capacitor, and the capacitor will provide those few milliseconds that the circuit might need of enough voltage to keep things going. So it's not exactly boost buck. It's just an old trick for keeping things working. Oh, I'm tired, and I'm tired of smelling sawdust. So back to you.
Thank you, Marty. The website for the Personal Computer Show is www.pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at PCRadio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN.FM on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio, or WBAI.org streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing. And back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.